Welcome to science class. How many of you believe in Bigfoot? Kind of believe in Bigfoot? Okay. How many of you absolutely state? It's got to be fake. Okay. That's excellent. No, I'm so glad we have some difference of opinion on that. Well, I'm glad to be speaking to a room full of educators and enthusiasts and hopefully people that like science, but maybe not. That's fine. I'm glad if you're here. And you probably didn't choose to teach science for the money you would get out of it. That's fine. You don't need to buy a yacht, especially if you really understand the molecular strength of water. Yachts are a bit more of a risky proposition. So we want to talk about teaching science effectively, how to explain the magic of the universe to somebody who's secretly much more interested in a YouTube video or TikTok, which when I went to school, that was the sound the clock made, and that was all it was. So, no one is born knowing how to teach science. Now, you might have a bent toward science. In other words, you might be naturally attracted to science, but that does not mean that you know how to teach it well. Does that make sense? Okay, so there's a difference between those two things. And I want to talk about trying to teach it instead of trying to necessarily teach you a science lesson, although we'll do a little bit of that too. So, and the fact is your students probably think that science is easy for you. And maybe you feel that, maybe it is, that's great. But I'm gonna guess that not all of you feel that way. But they don't see that. They think that you're just born and you know, this is just, you've always known this. You've always known the laws of thermodynamics or whatever. So learning to teach science is actually an art. It's a messy art. It's sometimes a loud and smelly and things like that. And you maybe have dreams of shaping the next Einstein. That's a big dream, I know. And instead you're Googling how to get, in my case, candle wax out of the carpet or soda volcanoes out of the carpet. So, welcome to science class. With our emotional dependency on many different things. So, first of all, the golden rule is never assume that they know anything. You have to explain every step. And if you say to them, well, y'all know what a cell membrane is. Y'all know what a cell membrane is. Somebody's going to be thinking, is that the new iPhone case? Or what? Okay. Now you can say, if you've taught that the previous class, whatever, you can say, remember how we talked about the cell membrane. But don't assume they know anything, because that makes them look stupid when they don't know, which they won't lots of times. So don't assume they know anything. Make sure you start with the smallest things and build forward. Assume nothing and explain everything, especially vocabulary. There was a science teacher that I was listening to recently, and he said, the biggest problem we have with teaching science in school is vocabulary. And because there's so many very specific terms and we expect them to learn it. And he said, it's okay. I should have written down his words so I would actually remember all of them. But the idea is that it's okay to use generic terms explaining things. Make sure they connect that way before you explained. Make sure they understand what you're talking about, I guess, basically. And I mean, if you read through your science book and just read and look, it's very difficult at times, right? So make sure they understand the terms. And so, for example, a word like theory, what does that mean? Do you know what the word theory means in science? Well, science. We understand our scientists understand that a theory is an idea or a hypothesis that's been researched and supported with years of data and experiments and things like that. Okay. For example, all the things that we understand about how atoms work and all the work that's gone into that and all the chemical experiments that we've done that actually prove that atomic theory is real. All that, and it's still called atomic theory, right? So it's not considered a law, I don't think, for most scientists anyway. Okay, so make sure that they understand the your vocabulary. So in teen speak, a theory generally just means something I just made up, right? Well, it's, yeah, my theory is, and we say that, you probably said it in church or whatever, and that's it. That's a different definition of theory. I'm not saying it's wrong, it's just different than the scientific theory. Do you understand what a hypothesis is? How many of you think you understand what a hypothesis is? Okay, can you explain it?
It's a proposition or a prediction about what's going to happen if I do this certain thing.
Correct.
The hypothesis is X is going to happen, Y.
Correct. And is this something you come up with instantly when you see one, when you observe one action, or is it?
You observe an action and say, I think this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So, that's good. That's exactly right. Okay, next point here quickly is, and this is not original with me, but if it doesn't blow up, it better light up. Engagement is key, especially with experiments. And I wish I had lots of experiments that would just blow up, but like I said, it was flying and chemicals and gunpowder and one of the things I wanted to bring. It's just a little more difficult, and I decided just to avoid the difficult conversations with the TSA agents and just bring what I could. Okay. Now, you don't need lots of pyrotechnics, but hands-on visual learning is very helpful. We are going to do some of that here, quickly here. So, when you explain the solar system, for example, if you can give them fruit, like Jupiter is a watermelon with a superiority complex a little bit. It's a big fruit. And Earth is a grape. And let's see. There's another one that's close to an orange. I think maybe Saturn is close to an orange. And let's see, Mercury. Mercury is maybe like a marble. So that's not a fruit. Technically, it's not a fruit. So, things like that, if they have an object that they're working with. And also metaphors. Metaphors are a great friend to you. After coffee, they're one of your best friends in science. And coffee, of course, is just a chemical. Actually, it's a bit of a chemical reaction, come to think of it, yeah. Okay, so metaphors. Cells are like cities. Think about that. City hall is the nucleus, or the nucleus is city hall. And the mitochondria is the power plants that run everything. And gravity, it's like that clingy friend that just won't let you go. And you can't get away from them. And atoms. Atoms are like the, kind of like Legos. I like that. Build everything. Everything is built off of atoms. And they're always underfoot, especially, which is typical of Legos, especially in a dark room when you're barefooted. Atoms are like that. And osmosis, if you can think about, and this one is particularly true for introverts. Osmosis is somebody sneaking out of a room because it's too full. An introvert might connect with that one better. Also, I think that in science class, humor is actually quite important. Why? I'm not exactly sure, but for another metaphor, humor is like a solvent. It helps mix everything. It helps everything work. And please have some bad science jokes. They're always groaners. Like a neutron walks into a restaurant and asks, "How much for a hamburger?" And the waiter says, "For you, there's no charge." Or why did the astronaut's girlfriend break up with him? Because she thought he needed too much space, of course. And so they'll groan and roll their eyes, especially teenagers. Oh, what a terrible joke. But they'll remember what a neutron is. So the joke is the Trojan horse. There's information inside that's valuable, right? And science is about, failure is an option, and it's a bit of a necessary one. If your science experiments always work perfectly, I'm just saying it's an option. But yes?
Can I give an example?
Sure.
So I don't even remember what the original science experiment was that I was trying to do. It was like boiling some water in this jar, and then the tube goes across to the other jar, mm-hmm. and it bubbles in there for a certain amount of time. You check the temperature, and you figure out, you weigh the water, and you see how much evaporated
sure.
and how much the temperature changed to show how much mm-hmm. calorie of heat is in a gram. It takes to change a gram of water from steam back to a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to do this, but it didn't work. So picture I have a jar on one side that I'm heating up, that the hose is going across into a jar of cold water.
Mm-hmm.
So this one that was boiling, we did it. It hardly bubbled. We couldn't, nothing changed. Didn't work. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But we're waiting for it. We unplugged the heater on this one. The tube's still over into the cold water.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there just kind of, oh, too bad. Well, it didn't work. We were working at some other stuff, but, you know, digging around some other science stuff. And slowly but surely, I said, oh, look at that. Water's coming up out of that cold water and sucking back over to the steam side.
Sure.
We watched it slowly but surely. It goes up and up and up, and then it goes over the edge
mm-hmm.
into the steam water, and all of a sudden, just we jumped back because it sucked tremendously powerful out of the cold water. Filled the thing full. And we learned big time science.
So that was, go ahead.
Cooled it in the jar that had been boiling. It, when the cold water started to pour over the edge, it cooled back down so fast that it shrunk the steam. Sure. Anyway, it made a vacuum.
Yeah. And probably at some point the seal, it sealed it, right? So there was no more air in the hose. And that's when it's just
right.
guessing. I don't know, but that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Failure, you often learn so much from failure. That's just perfect. I would have thought we orchestrated that. It was a perfect point. But there's been so many things like that. But lots of times for me, you know, it just didn't work. So that's life too. You can actually learn a life lesson from that. Sometimes it just doesn't go the way you think it will. And let them make mistakes. Embrace the disasters. If the baking soda volcano doesn't fizz, well, that's a chemistry that doesn't cooperate. And that's part of life, too. I think one year in particular, the experiment that my students remembered the most, in fact, they wrote about in the annual one they remembered way too long, is when I had a roaring fire in the gym. When my ratio of alcohol and I forget what else it was, water I think, spilled out in, it was in the gym, I mean it was fine, there's no problem, but it was just a bit alarming. Anyway. Okay. And also the why should I care principle here. Students are expert in detecting irrelevance. Why are we learning this? Their radar for that is sharp and honest. and extremely negative. And it's often when they don't really understand what they're learning, okay? So if you tell them that you're learning about stoichiometry, let's learn about stoichiometry today. Maybe that fills you with joy, but they're just like, what is that? I probably won't like it. And it's the recipe for chemical reactions, essentially, approximate. That's, if you start with a real world application, I think it usually goes a lot better. So by the way, how many of you know how soap works? Basic idea of how soap works, okay. But I was pretty sure some of you would. I have an idea of it. Quite a bit more developed than it used to be. And yet I still find it interesting because it's not quite as simple as I used to think it was. But essentially it's because soap molecules have, it's a long molecule here. I should have done this ahead of time, but let's say it looks like this, sort of. I don't know. This one is kind of red. And this one is kind of blue. And one end of this thing is hydrophobic, which means it hates water, and the other end is hydrophilic, which means it loves water. And so this one, the blue one, let's say that's hydrophilic. This is the end that loves water. And this one hates water, but it loves grease. Okay? And so those things, as you put soap in a bowl that you're going to wash, for example, why those things float around and they orient themselves around the grease. So here's a little grease thing here, and all these things will be, the grease end will be pointing towards the grease, the little bit of grease in there, and the other end will be out here. And this is the one that loves the water out here. And actually, the best way to look at that is to look at a computer animation. The best way for me to understand that was to actually look at a computer animation. I was going to talk about technology later. And it is your friend and enemy both in science. Anyway, but the soap molecules surround the bit of grease, and they actually lift it up. And it makes it easy for, when you're rinsing something, for you to rinse all the grease off, because they're picked up by all these soap molecules, which I found fascinating. Oh, that's how it works. That's not completely how it works. There's also, it works through breaking down surface tension. And then there's some other elements that they put in soap, certain kinds of soap that have another effect, which I don't even understand. But that's basically how soap works, which I think is interesting. And you can see it in physics. Why does your, if everything's made up of atoms, for example, which is an interesting theory, which I believe, by the way. So this is made up of atoms, then this bowl of water is made up of atoms. If you drop an egg into a bowl of water, it just, but if you drop it here, it'll break. Why? Well, there's two things. There's physics. basically, it's surface tension and impact force. Okay, those two things. And then you could talk about that. Why does it feel hotter when it's humid? I just noticed the difference here, since I just dumped my finger in this bowl of water here. It's not terribly humid in here. But out in Oregon, where I live, you dip your finger in a bowl of water, it'll be dry, and just right now it's dry. Well, here it's still wet. So, evaporative cooling is what's happening. And, oh, I was also going to mention, dip your finger in just up to the knuckle there and raise it out, and you can feel how much cooler that is. And there's two things that are happening with that. One is that the water is cool and it cools down your skin. That's a big thing. But even more than that, the evaporative effect of the water actually, it is actually evaporating slowly, but it is still evaporating, and there's a cooling action. That, okay. So, thermodynamics, how does a microwave work? Do you know how a microwave works? Just simply, can somebody just venture an explanation of how a microwave works? Why is, for example, you have that plate that sits in the microwave, and you have an enormous family and all their relatives, and you're all heating up three slices of pizza each, so that in a minute and a half of each one. So 30 people come through. That's a terrible way to cook your lunch. You should not do it, but just say you did. And here's this plate just getting heated up and heated up and heated up and heated up. Why doesn't it blow up? I mean, eventually it has to get too hot, right? Why doesn't it?
Don't the microwaves excite water molecules and turn them to heat?
That's exactly right, yes. Yeah, they only are basically just work on the water molecules that are in your food. And they don't really heat up ceramic very much because there's very low water content in ceramic. Now, I understand there is some, actually, just a tiny little bit. So usually if your plate is really, really hot when you pick it up, there's a tiny trace bits of it maybe in there. I'm not sure about that. But basically it's from heat transfer from the food to the plate. Okay. Now sometimes I'm skeptical of that in a little bit in a way, because sometimes I've heated up food and my mashed potatoes are still cold and my plate is burning hot. What's going on there? So. It's probably just a faulty microwave. Got it from Home Depot. You know. Microbiology is terribly interesting too, and we could understanding antibiotics, and that's a big discussion. Maybe that's not an excellent one to start with as you try to understand it, but it is. It's a good thing to talk about. One of the things that I'm very interested in and become interested in it is genetics. And let's see, how many redheads do we have here? I don't even see any, but okay, yeah. We got some. Okay. So, people told me when I was growing up, you know, redheads are, that's a recessive gene, that means all the redheads are basically dying out. Well, that's not true. Did you know that? That's not true. Recessive gene does not mean that trait is dying out. And I'm not exactly sure why it's termed recessive. Although I have a vague idea. But are you familiar with the Pune square? Some people say Punet, but I think it's Pune actually. And this illustrates, there's three terms here. This is allele. And this is a bit of DNA, I'm just gonna say, it's a bit of DNA that you get from your parents. So you get one allele from your mother, and you get one from your father. All understand that? Two from, okay, that's in this particular case. I know it's way more complicated than that, but we'll just say that's the way it is. Okay? And phenotype. Does anybody know what a phenotype is? What is it?
That's the actual color over here?
Yeah, excellent. Yeah.
In that case.
Yeah, so it's, in this case, it would be if you had red hair, you would have the phenotype. The genotype is what? Yes?
What your genes actually are.
Yeah, excellent. That's what your genes actually are. Okay, so isn't that the same thing? I mean, if you've got Levi jeans, you've got Levi jeans. What's the deal here? So this really helped me understand this thing, and I was fascinated by it. And there's another one that I'm terribly fascinated by. I want to tell you about too. Let's say that you have a mother and a father that have. Let's see. I feel like I'm skipping a step here. So make sure we understand this. A phenotype of here. So let's say we have somebody with red hair. That's their phenotype. And in case, if they have red hair, that's also their genotype. Okay? And this is what we're talking about here. So, I should have planned a little bit more how I was going to explain this. But right here, this is this person's genotype. Okay, it's RR. And I want to say that a capital R means brown hair. And a lowercase r means red hair. And it is a bit more complicated than that, by the way, because red hair, the allele for red hair is also the same or similar for blonde hair. Okay, so that makes sense. So every person in the whole world has two alleles. You get one from your father, one from your mother. So let's say that your father has brown hair. But you don't actually know if his genotype, well, you know that he has the phenotype for, actually you do know he has the genotype for brown hair, but you don't know that he doesn't have the phenotype for red hair, the genotype for red hair. Because this particular, so, see, I can tell I'm just not explaining this. Okay, let's see here. So I've got a set of parents here that their genotype is RR. That means they do not have in their genetic makeup the allele for brown hair. And the only way you know that is by genetic studies, right? And I think you can tell through genetic study. So let's say there's a couple from China. Or China, they have brown hair, they have black hair there. But there is no red hair in the history of that whole family, of either side. They might have this genotype. Mom and dad might have that genotype, okay? And that means the chance that they have a red-haired child is zero. They're only going to have brown hair. That type of couple is so rare that I think it does exist somewhere, but it's very rare. Most couples are like this, and they get, so they might be brown-haired, because most people are brown-haired, right? And so they get one allele from their mother and one from their father. One there and one there. Oops. No, that's wrong. You gotta go here and here and here and here. But there's a chance here that this brown-haired couple, these both have brown hair, there's a chance that they could have a red-haired child. It's a 25% chance they could have a red-haired child. Does that make sense? Sort of. And then the same thing follows through here. Mom has brown hair and dad has red hair. Okay? And there's actually still a 50% chance that they have red-haired children. If they both have red hair, the only allele that they pass on, that they can pass on, is the lowercase r, which means their children will be red-haired or blonde-haired. Okay? So recessive doesn't mean they're dying out. Okay, and there's another important fact in here, and that is if the child is born with this gene, the uppercase letter always will be their genotype. So I didn't explain that, okay. I knew I didn't have quite enough time to really explain that well, but I've been fascinated by that. So just a practical application of this, it's really simple. Is this. If you have attached or if you have unattached earlobes and you marry somebody with unattached earlobes, your children will likely have unattached earlobes. But not necessarily. But if you both have attached earlobes, your children will all have attached earlobes. That's a recessive trait. But if you both have it, It's the only trait that you pass on. Does that make sense?
Well, isn't there a dominant trait too?
There's a dominant trait, and that's what's a little bit confusing, because the recessive trait is also dominant. If that's the only, so if you are redheaded, that means you have two recessive traits. So you're going to pass one of those on to all of your children. And if you marry somebody who's also redheaded, they also have two recessive traits, which they're going to pass on to all of their children. So, you know, put the two together and you've got recessive traits is what you're passing on. Which is interesting that that's called dominant, because if two brown-haired people marry each other, they can have a red-headed child. Yes?
Isn't it dominant because that's the trait that gets expressed if you have both of them?
That's why it is. That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, that's true. If you think about it that way, the lowercase one is always submissive to the dominant one. Okay. Anyway, genetics. I think they're fascinating. And another one, if you're baking cookies, you're talking about chemistry, putting things together, heat transfer, heating them up, and the Maillard reaction, which I find interesting because I like food. And I like the science of food. And it's a chemical reaction between amino acids and reducing sugar, and it creates the lovely aromas that you get, and it also creates a lovely taste. And it's why high-end chefs use a torch, and they'll torch off the top of the dessert or the side of a steak that's just a little bit off or different things like that. They want to make sure that they have that reaction is in all their food. Okay, there's lots of things like that to talk about. It's good to remember to be safe. Live with a little bit of danger, but it's good to make sure you're safe. Don't trust the middle schooler with a Bunsen burner, unless you've got fire protection. Goggles are a really good idea too, by the way. In certain instances, and the problem with it, I don't need it for this particular one, and that's when I've needed it. My worst scenario was we had a real trend of trying to build the most powerful and fastest little electric motors one time. And so you get this, and you get a battery, you put it together, and make it spin. And here's a little problem for you, too, if somebody wants to come and fix this one. This one should work, but I don't think it's going to work. Let's see if it does. Why doesn't that thing work? How many of you have made these things? So, if you put these little things together, I was going to do this tomorrow, and then I just say, yeah, come on, bring one of these. And you can make a motor with a battery and a neodymium magnet and a bit of copper wire to make that thing spin. This one's not spinning. That was a little bit. But they'll often will spin really well. Anyway. So I was making better and better ones in developing. That one big problem you have is the wire will fall off. So I got little rubber washers that are put there, and the wire would stay in there. It's like, hey, if I would just put a little dent in this battery, that actually makes it stick really well. What do I have to make? Oh yeah, here's this tester. So I just, and I poked through the battery, and it shot me right in the eye. Little quick run to the doctor. I did have a contact in there, which probably really, really helped. But it really was bad. They shot some steroid into my eye to heal it. And that was another little scientific thing that was amazing, because it like dilated my eye and made it stay that way. So I had one pupil that was hugely dilated. And it was weird. My students, they thought it was amusing. Anyway, try to be safe. It's a good idea. This is a lab. Keep our eyes covered up so no one cries. Technology is your friend and your enemy, too. That's one of the things I struggle with a little bit. That I'm trying to teach some content here that they turn 15 or whatever it is that they get a phone, and they just, there it is, right there. And they won't remember it. But it's really helpful to use technology to explain things. So make it your friend, not your master. Use tech wisely. You don't have to Google everything. Google is not God. Did you ever, any of you ever hear of Googleism, by the way? It's a tiny little bit of a side trail. But there is kind of a, I think it's a real thing, almost a movement, where people say, actually, Google is God. I mean, it's omniscient, it knows everything. It's everywhere, there's internet all over it, so it's omnipresent. And there's a few other things. There's like 10 things that they have in the Church of Google, Googleism. It could be a complete fake that somebody cooked up, that's the thing, but there is a web page for it. And somebody preached a message on it and they said it's real, so who knows? I mean, I'm assuming he did the research. Okay. You know, in it, essence, science, teaching science, is about wonder and that transfer of wonder. If you can get your students to think, wait, is that why? That's success right there. It's really not the content. It's really not the content, because they're going to forget most of that. But if they can learn the method for teaching or for learning, if you can spark curiosity, that's the true, I would like to know more curiosity that you have when you have a hobby that you really want to get better at. And if you can help the students look at the world and see more than just facts. So the real goal isn't content, it's confidence. And this is helpful for me to remember when I think back about how few of the formulas and data that I learned in school I actually remember or even used, honestly. But I did learn how to study a little bit. So we also want to make science something that students feel like they can do, okay? Science isn't just for geniuses and lab coats. It's for them. It's for the kid who's scared of math, who's scared that he can't get a good grade in math. It's for the one who doodles aliens in the margins a little bit. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's true. And it's also for the one who asks, is spaghetti a liquid or a solid? Which is an interesting question, actually. If you think about it, I mean, a solid is something that holds its shape. And, So effective science teaching isn't about knowing all the answers, because science is always learning new things. And it's about inviting students into the process of discovery. And if there happens to be messes or anything like that, welcome to science class, because that's all part of it. I was going to mention, too, one of the things that I would kind of sucker for is just gadgets. I just love scientific gadgets. Make this work. Which I think is just neat. And if you don't have one of these things and one of these things in your classroom, they're really cheap, and you can get them. And they're so neat, I think. So this one here is a magnetic top. This is not one of the better ones. The better ones are quite a bit more solid, and they will work a lot better. But, and some of them actually have something attached where you can pull a string and zing, and they run and run. I think there's some that'll run for days. But and I experimented with trying to turn it, like tilt it up, but that messes up the, you know what? It knows you all are watching here. Oh dear. I was suspicious that the hacking job that I had, so that one has some magnets in the bottom of it, and if you get it started, it's a kinetic motion machine. that just does that quite a lot. Oh, this is one of these things too. We're talking about heat transfer. This is called a hand boiler. And all that is, it's nothing specific in there, it's just colored water, I think. But it's a finely balanced tube there. And essentially, if you put your hand on it, the heat of your hand will make the water go up the tube and into the top. Essentially, it's boiling. All right. So water boils at what temperature? 212.
At sea level.
And only, that's not even quite accurate there, too, which is, I found fascinating. So the Celsius scale is a bit more accurate that way. Do you know what temperature water boils on Mount Everest? What temperature does water boil on Mount Everest? About 150, 152. So the poor climbers there that trying to boil water for tea, the tea is kind of terribly hot. Something they face, because it does. It just boils at 152. It doesn't get any hotter. 156, something like that. One of the other ones that's fun to do, when you're talking about surface tension, is trying to place a paper clip on water. How many of you have done that? Okay. You can make that paper clip just float on the water. And why does it do that? I was going to talk about surface tension for the top of atoms just a little bit. You know why surface tension works? Or why? Why can you float a paper clip on water? Because water has very low surface tension. Well, it still does. It still has some surface tension. There's hydrophonic bonding going on. And surface tension is basically the fact that all these molecules, these water molecules are reaching out to hold on to each other, right? So molecules are just reaching out to hold on to each other because they don't want to be split apart. And the ones at the top have to reach out sideways with some of their funny arms. And so they are holding on more sideways because there's nothing up top, and it creates a little bit stronger skin on the top of the liquid. And some liquids don't have it, or have very, very low. There's almost nothing. Okay. Oh, yes! I had something that I thought would be interesting to do, but we don't really have time. But how many of you believe in Bigfoot? This was the thing I forgot to write in my notes. Talk about scientific theory. Is it just me, or are there way more conspiracies now than there used to be? I mean, where are these coming from?
The internet.
Yeah. Pat McManus said it about the best, actually. He said, it used to be there was a crazy old man up on the mountain, and you just knew he was crazy. But now, Crazy Ned can find 1,000 other people in the world that think just like him, and now he's got a real following. And I mean, there's some truth to that. You can find somebody who thinks just like you, and you tend to just cling to that person and disregard the people that are beside you. That's a problem. And I think it's affecting the scientific community a little bit too. Scientific community. It's affecting us as we think about science. And we get an interesting idea, and we find 300 people or 3,000 people from New Zealand all the way around the world that think the way we do, and obviously we're right because we have all these people that are supporting us. Okay. So what about Bigfoot? Why did I mention that? The place that I live out there in Blue Mountains is a hotbed of Bigfoot sightings. And there is a long history of Sasquatch, or out there it's called Sasquatch. Other places it's called different things. And it's interesting to me, some people absolutely believe in it. People in science. people that are completely respectable. And I always thought it was a joke. I mean, that's what Pat McManus joked about being scared of when it was dark. But I moved out there, and it's serious. I think most of the population in Pacific Northwest believes in it. I'm going to say over half. Well, why is that? Because they know somebody who knows a friend who saw one. So that's what we call anecdotal evidence. It's not really evidence, but it's kind of convincing. And what I actually wanted you to do is get together in little groups, the pros and the cons, and debate it, because I did that in school. You know what's interesting? You know what side they came out on? Anyway, so it is fascinating to me to look into it. I am skeptical because why is it that nobody's ever caught one? Right? With all the cameras and game cameras, why is it that all the pictures we have are some grainy, funny thing running away through the brush, except for the one video that was taken in 1980 or 1970 or something? So, is it real or not? You're dismissed.